This is Playing with Fire.
He's at the 20, the 10, the 5. Touchdown!
3 seconds remaining. 2-1. Shots up. It's good!
Here's the pitch, the swing. It's a long fly ball. It's going, going, it's gone! Revealing the secrets of the elite athlete. But be careful, you're playing with fire.
Freestyle. Hey everybody, how are you? I'm Dr. Bill Thierfelder, your host for Playing with Fire, and I think we have a great show for you today. It's on how to make your dreams a reality, being true to yourself and others, plus sharpening your focus and playing with juice. So let's get going. Listen up. Well, welcome, everybody. This is another episode of Playing with Fire, and I'm doing something different today, as you can probably hear by the surround sound that's going on. Finally have the portable recording device that I've now brought outside. I'm outside the studio, and I'm actually out here with Chris Horn, who's a wide receiver with the Carolina Panthers, and his wife Amy, and is it Francis?
Yep.
We have Francis and Christopher with us. How old is Christopher?
He's two,
and Francis is?
5 months.
Woo. I know you're living in chronic fatigue then, you know. But we kind of came out here today, and I thought maybe we could talk a little bit with Chris about some of the things we've discussed on this, you know, podcast before in the interviews about spore as a means for developing virtue. And I thought also we'd try to get in a few drills, because Chris is getting ready for the season, and maybe we could, you know, take a look at a few things, and we'll see how it goes. So let me get it right. You know, 4 years in the NFL.
Right.
New Orleans Saints, Kansas City Chiefs, right. And now the Carolina Panthers.
Correct.
You've just moved into the area, haven't you?
Yes.
Where were you before this?
We live in Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay, so yeah. You still came to nice weather.
Yeah.
You know, this, matter of fact, this might be even nicer for you. It's not quite as hot, you know?
You're right, exactly. Don't have that scorching desert.
Right. And your college was in Billings, Montana. It was Rocky Mountain?
Rocky Mountain College.
Rocky Mountain College. And
A little school.
How big was it?
1,000 students.
1,000 students. So, yeah. See, there's a lot of hope for everybody out there that, you know, you can come from a small school, right. You can live a life of virtue, you know, and still make the NFL. So I thought what we'd do is maybe just chat a little bit. And, again, part of what you can hear is got some trucks behind us over here and some other things. But tell me, Chris, just from your standpoint, what do you think about this whole idea of sport as a means for developing virtue? You know, is it pie in the sky? You know, can you really do it? Just what are your thoughts about it?
I personally think it's huge. I think we live in a culture that values sport. And I think from that standpoint, it's a perfect means to teach virtue and even a step there to teach faith and evangelize. Because when you think about it, growing up as a kid in America, or wherever you are really, it's hardly a day goes by where either on the radio or on the TV or whatever you're exposed to that there's not some kind of sport that you can turn on and enjoy watching. So that being said, I think all the discipline that goes into training for sport and practicing, all those skills that are learned and practiced and trained daily, I think can carry over to faith, the faith side of building your faith, building virtue, and teaching, I really think, proclaiming the gospel.
Right. Now, you know, the problem we see in today's world is that the media focuses so much on the vice part of it.
Right.
And so, you know, pro sports to some degree has become that poster child for vice very often. And I don't know what your experience has been, maybe you could tell us, but I've found that most of the NFL players that I've met and worked with over the years are really good, solid guys. I mean, these are good people. And so this picture you see of this vice thing going on doesn't seem to really be the majority that's in there. And yet, that's what's out there, and that affects colleges, it affects high schools, it affects youth. Why do you think there is so much of this vice?
Well, I think you hit it on the head a little bit there, because the majority of the guys are really good guys, but I don't think that sells news. I think is what sells news is obviously they try to get, they, anytime somebody does something, whatever it is, it's front page of the sports page across the country or on ESPN as the lead story.
Right.
But by far the majority of the guys are really good guys, and that's what I've experienced. But you know, there's always, you are going to come across, and I've come across, you know, you're exposed, is what we are, is, you know, we're young guys given a lot of money, and a lot of attention, so fame, and then the fact that you're in a business that builds your body, so it kind of has a recipe for a disaster if you want to go down the wrong road,
so
there is that side of it, and I've seen plenty of guys involved in that side, but I really believe truly that the majority of the guys, it's just quietly done, are good people.
What about the faith part of it? You know, very often it's looked at as being something separate. You know, we go out, we perform, you get the game and so forth. After the game, there may be some kneeling down and praying, which is a good thing. You know, maybe privately there's some Bible studies being done that really not many people even know about.
Right.
How does the rest of it, you know, how does this work? I mean, is there really, does there have to be this separation between your faith and your performance?
See, I think that's one of the biggest crimes, and no matter what you do in life, if you try to separate your faith from whatever it is you're doing, you know, and in my case, it's being a pro athlete, but even if you're a businessman, to try and say, well, that's nice at church, or that's nice in theory, or whatever it may be, but it doesn't really work in the real world, is really foolish to say. I think my faith makes me a better football player.
Mm-hmm.
I really do to take how I work, and when I'm tired and I want to skip like several lifts, or I want to skip or skimp out on a run, or not work as hard as I should, and a lot of time no one would even know.
Right.
You know, I can raise my thoughts in my heart to, you know, I can think about Jesus carrying the cross, or I can think about you know, just different parts of it, and a lot of them are from praying the rosary, you know, the mysteries of the rosary, specifically the sorrowful mysteries, and that definitely lifts my spirits and gives me the strength really at that time to say, okay, no, I need to do this, because not because I'm trying to get a reward by the coach saying attaboy, but because I need to glorify God.
What's hot? Well, today I thought I'd do something a little different. I read a book recently called Season of Life, and it was written by Jeffrey Marks. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner, and it was a great book. It's about Joe Ehrman, who's a former NFL football star with the Indianapolis Colts, and he is now a defensive line coach, I believe it was defensive line coach, with Gilman High School. And I thought it was just an interesting story because it took a different twist, and so much of this podcast is focused on the whole idea of sport as a means for developing virtue, and that seems to be what he and his partner, his partner's name was Francis Biff Poggi, P-O-G-G-I-E. I hope I pronounced that correctly. But basically, they had come together and formed this team, and it's just a little bit different. I'm just going to read you a little bit from the jacket of this thing. It goes, Joe Ehrman, a former NFL star and volunteer coach for the Gilman High School football team, teaches his players the keys to a successful defense. Penetrate, pursue, punish, love. Love? A former captain of the Baltimore Colts and now an ordained minister, Ehrman is serious about the game of football, but is even more serious about the purpose of life. Season of Life is this inspirational story as told by the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jeffrey Marks, who was ball boy for the Colts when he first met Ehrman. Ehrman now devotes his life to teaching young men a whole new meaning of masculinity. He teaches the boys at Gilman the precepts of his Building Men for Others program. Being a man means emphasizing relationships and having a cause bigger than yourself. It means accepting responsibility and leading courageously. It means the empathy, integrity, and living of life of service to others are more important than points on a scoreboard. And I just thought, you know, I'm not going to read you too much here because I know you don't want to hear me read a book to you. But this will just give you a feel for what he is doing and how it might be a little bit different. So I'm just going to read you this one little portion from the book, and I think you'll get a sense of it. Okay, bring it up, boys. The booming voice prompted immediate scurrying toward the center and nearby zone. Let's go, everybody, up. He shouted instructions emanated from an oversized teddy bear of a man, big, thick guy with a buzz cut of a brown hair, wearing baggy nylon mesh shorts and a Gilman t-shirt with the sleeves cut away to free his massive upper arms. He was the head coach, Francis Biff Poggi, a former Gilman football player, class of 79, and now a wealthy business owner who devoted much of his time to philanthropy. Financial management was his business. His local investment company, Samuel James Limited, had been quite successful in a wide range of public and private equity deals. But working with children was his passion. Biff was Joe's best friend and the man whom he had started building Men for Others with. Their roles varied depending on the setting and context in which they implemented their program for boys and men, but at Gilman they generally stuck with a single formula. Joe was the ecclesiastic authority who often stood in the shadows but always provided wisdom and guidance. Biff was the program's public face and its animated voice, and now it was time for his opening remarks to the team. In a sense, the same scene was unfolding that very day, or perhaps it would happen in the next week or so on high school fields throughout the nation. Tough guys, all of shapes and sizes, were strapping on helmets with the boundless excitement of youth and the anticipation that comes with a clean slate of a new year. On another level, though, what happened that first day at Gilman was entirely unlike anything normally associated with high school football. It started with the signature exchange of the Gilman football program, this time between Biff and the gathered throng of 80 boys, freshmen through seniors, who would spend the next week practicing together before being split into varsity and junior teams. "What is our job?" Biff asked on behalf of himself, Joe, and the eight other assistant coaches. "To love us," most of the boys yelled back. The older boys had already been through this routine more than enough times to know the proper answer. The younger boys, new to Gilman football, would soon catch on. "And what is your job?" Biff shot back. "To love each other," the boys responded. I would quickly come to realize that this standard exchange, always initiated by Biff or Joe, was just as much a part of Gilman football as running or tackling. I don't care if you're big or small, huge muscles or no muscles, never even played football or a star of a team. I don't care about any of that stuff, Biff went on to tell the boys, who sat in the grass while he spoke. If you're here, then you're one of us, and we love you. Simple as that. Biff paused. "Look at me, boys," he started again. Most of them were already staring up in at least the general direction of the 6'3", 300-pound frame. Thanks to the combination of his physical stature and his never-ending passion for both football and the overwhelming well-being of his players, my boys, he always called them, Biff never had much of a problem holding their attention. I'm going to stop there. That's a long time to read, but I think you get an idea of what this book is going to be about. And this is a very successful football team. It was ranked as one of the top 10 on the East Coast. So there's something going on here that you can still be very successful, and you can hear the kinds of things that they seem to be emphasizing. And so I'd recommend this book to you called Season of Life. Praying Twice. Well, we've talked about on this podcast in some episodes previous to this about the idea that we should be thankful in all things. And this song sort of caught my attention. The title of it is The Bad Times Aren't So Bad, and it's by J.D. Herring, and I hope you enjoy it.
Tell me a story of a love that never ends. Like a willow weeping in the chill and wind to wind. Sing a song of the love we've had, growing strong through the good times and the bad times aren't so bad. Story of a love that loves till death. Like an eagle soaring high, sailing free on spring's sweet breath. Sing a song of the love we've had, growing strong through the good times. About another broken heart, lost you. lost you a love that ended before it even started. Tell me a story of a love that never ends. Tell me a story.
That was J.D. Herring with The Bad Times Aren't So Bad, and you can find that on GarageBand.com, or you can check out our show notes at ReclaimTheGame.com. It's your call. I recently received a question, and it was, how can I get faster? And it said, is it possible to lower my 40-yard time by 0.2 or more? Well, it could be. You know, just working with some of the NFL players, getting them ready for the NFL Combine, very interestingly, as I've pointed out, and again, I may have talked about this sometime earlier, you know, 0.1 seconds is such a small interval of time. I mean, if you took a stopwatch and tried to start and stop it as fast as you could, you can't even do it in 0.1 seconds. It probably takes you 0.3 seconds. And so 0.1 seconds are just incredibly short. You can gain and lose them in less than a heartbeat. So the question is, can you gain 0.2 seconds? Can you get faster? And I'd say to you, typically, yes. You know, there's very few people I've ever seen that have everything so well put together that I'd say to them, that's about it. Now, maybe after you've mastered certain things, and I'm just going to give you a couple things or maybe several things that are going to contribute to a faster 40 time. You know, one is one that's kind of maybe boring that people don't want to hear about, but, you know, flexibility, mobility. If you don't have good flexibility or mobility, it means you don't have full range of motion, which means from a technical standpoint, even if you were being shown the right technique, you're not going to be able to get your body into that position. So having flexibility is really important. Obviously, you need maximum strength. You need to have, you know, a strong body that you've, you know, lifted. You developed your overall strength. You then need explosive strength. And that explosive strength are the kind of things that we've talked about. You know, plyometrics and those kinds of things, depth jumps and so forth. Speed work in terms of your training, that you're actually running sprints. You're running fast intervals. Technique, it's critical that you're, you know, the way that your body moves has a lot to do with the efficiency, meaning how fast it can move. And then certainly the mental part of speed is really important. And so all of those factors go into getting you faster. But as just an example, when I've worked with these NFL players, getting them ready for their 40 times for the NFL Combine, we've gained 0.1 seconds just in the first 6 feet. Now, that might be hard to believe, but again, the efficiency in terms of how you leave your start position can gain you 0.1 seconds right there. So again, unless you've mastered all the things that I just talked about, I would say to you, yes, it's absolutely possible. It's something that you need to maybe have somebody take a look at you that lives near you, that has some expertise in this area, that might be able to help you with a few of these things and give you something to work on. So I hope that's of some help to you. I'd like to get your comments and feedback about the show. Please call our listener line. It's 206-203-1301, or you can write to me at feedback@reclaimthegame.com. And I also want to make sure that you know it's really helpful to me if you can go to iTunes. I know some people listen to it right. They download it right from our website, the www.reclaimthegame.com. But if you can go to iTunes and actually look up the Playing With Fire podcast and then do a review on it, that helps to increase the rankings on iTunes. And I'd like to see the rankings continue to grow so that this becomes more popular and we kind of get a movement going here of people that want to see sport as a means for developing virtue. So look forward to your future comments.
Skills and drills.
Well, I'm going to take a chance here on trying to describe a drill to you that I found very useful. I've sort of created these over time. They're a set of ball drills. And one of the hardest things about doing this particular section on the podcast is that I'm trying to describe this technically physical, you know, activities to you with words. And that's not an easy thing to do, especially in a very short segment. But these ball drills I've used for a number of different, developments, if you will, of different types of skills. And so the first one I'm going to describe to you, it seems very simple. I use like a little rubber ball the size of a racquetball. And I'd have somebody stand maybe 10 feet, in front of me. And I'd hold one of these balls in my hand, and I'd say, okay, I'm going to now toss you this ball, and I'm going to ask you to catch it with your left or right hand. And as I let it go from my hand, I won't wait, you know, till it's in the air. As it leaves my hand, I'm going to call out left or right, and then you just catch it with your left or right hand. Now, what's interesting about this drill, at first, the person doesn't know what the heck we're doing. So I toss out the ball, and I'll say left. And so they catch it with their left. And typically, the way somebody catches the ball the first time is they kind of put their palm up, you know, towards the sky, and they wait for the ball to kind of come to it, and they just sort of cradle it in, and they catch it. And I was like, okay. So I take the ball back, and I said, now, how'd you catch that ball? I said, well, I just caught it, you know. I said, okay, well, let's try this again. I said, are you really ready? And then I'll just kind of throw the ball up right in front of me, only maybe a foot or two in front of me, and obviously they're 10 feet away, and they are not ready to go get that ball because they are standing up too upright, their legs aren't in a bent position where they're in a ready type position, their energy's not up, they're not really focused on seeing the ball. And so that helps them to start to get the point that they need to be ready each time because, again, you're preparing for the unexpected. You're preparing for your ability to react and move very quickly in most sports. And by the way, these drills help you not just if you're in a sport that requires catching, but just your ability to focus and the energy that it takes to react to things. This drill can be very helpful. So now I'll say, okay, I'm going to toss you the ball again, left or right. I toss it out, and again, he gives me this very passive catch with the hand. I said, now, could you have taken that ball a little bit sooner? And the person usually says, well, yeah, I guess I could. And so then I show them that actually the way you want to catch the ball each time is instead of your palm up to the sky, you actually want your palm over the top of the ball because that means that you actually went out and grabbed the ball. And what you want to always do is grab the ball as quickly and as fast as you possibly can, and you want to get it as soon as you possibly can. So now I start doing the left-right thing again, and obviously I'm throwing left to the left side, right to the right side, as I call it. But then once I start to see they have it, they got good energy, they seem to be catching the ball well, they're grabbing it quickly with their hand, I'll now throw the ball to their right side, but I'll still call left. And usually that doesn't work for them the first time. They end up catching with their right hand, even though I said left. And then they kind of smile and they sort of get the idea. And then we start going. And it's amazing to me the transformation that happens with somebody doing this drill where it goes from this incredible, passive, just sort of standing there, taking a ball in, which, by the way, what happens very often in competition is very much like that. You may not think so, but that's what happens. We're really not ready for what's coming. And then by the end of this drill, it's amazing to me the amount of energy and intensity and the way somebody can take a ball and how sharp it looks. It looks like something from, fighting ninjas or something. You know, they're incredible. They look like their hands are flashing through the air. They're grabbing balls out of the air. It's incredible. And then what I'll do is I'll actually advance the drill and I'll go to two balls. So I'll throw one. I'll say left, right. And they'll have to catch it in that order. And it's amazing to start to see this. And the people are just able to, so quickly adapt to this. So if you can find yourself a partner, it'd be something I'd recommend to you. Again, there's a number of these kind of drills. Maybe I'll talk about a few of them in other episodes. But start off by just trying that one out. And I think you'll find that your focus and your energy. And the one last thing I'll leave you is make sure you're seeing the ball out of the person's hand. That you're not waiting until it's sort of coming at you as sort of a colored blur. You want to see the ball in detail. Leave the person's hand, then you know exactly where it's going. So give it a try and let me know how that works. Iron Will. I want to talk about something today that most of you may have heard about, and that's called goal setting. How do we do effective goal setting? It's interesting. Research shows that publicly stating your goal is an important part to realizing it. And I think back to my own experience. I remember when I was competing at the University of Maryland, going into my senior year, I said that I was going to be All-American. And I said this publicly. And I wasn't saying it in a bragging kind of way. I just was very determined that I was going to be an All-American. And, I went through the season, and there's only so many meets in a season, like maybe 10 or 11 meets. And during the course of that season, you need to qualify for the national championships, the NCAA Division I national championships. And so, meet went by after meet, and I still had not qualified. And actually, and the whole time, by the way, I'm saying I'm going to be All-American, and at some point people are saying, well, you haven't even qualified for nationals yet. I don't know how you're going to be, because you have to place at nationals. You have to be in the top six in the country in order to be All-American. So I haven't even qualified for the meet yet, never mind, making All-American at it. So anyway, I keep going. I'm convinced I am going to be All-American. And by the way, this isn't just pie in the sky. I'm working hard. I'm doing everything I should be doing. But I was very determined this was where I was going to go. And so I kept saying it. And we came to the last meet of the year. was the IC4A championships held at Princeton, and it's kind of mostly just the East Coast, you know, universities and colleges. And anyway, so I'm at this meet. I still haven't qualified, and I just was determined that I'm going to make it. So I end up, believe it or not, qualifying for nationals in that last meet. Well, people are very happy for me that I made nationals, but I keep saying I'm going to be All-American. They said, "Well, look, Bill, you know, look, you just barely made it. You know, you just qualified. You know, it's great that you're going to nationals, but." You know, to be top six in the nation, that's another story. So I'm going, and I'm in my mind, I'm saying I'm gonna be an All-American. So I get to the national championships, and there's two rounds. There's a qualifying day that you have to jump a certain height just to get to the finals, and then there's the finals, and that's when you have your opportunity to make All-American. So first day comes, I jump the qualifying height. I came in at the height. It was like, I forget what it was, 6'10", 6'11", or something. If you cleared that on your first attempt, or, you know, you were in. So I cleared that, and so I was in the finals. And the next day is the finals. And so, you know, I'm aware of each height and how many guys are left and what height I'm going to have to jump to be All-American. And it comes down that I'm finally jumping at the height that I know that if I clear this height, I'm going to be All-American. And I think it was, I might be off on my memory, I think it was about 7'2", 7 feet 2 inches. And I remember, you know, running, you know, up to the bar, first attempt, and I miss. I'm like, okay, you know, that's okay. I come back, and, you know, a few other guys go, and then I get called again. I go, and I miss again. I'm like, ooh. You get three jumps on the high jump, by the way, if you didn't know that. So I'm down to my last jump. I'm taking my approach, and as I get about 10 feet away from the bar, a photographer runs out and actually bumps into me as I'm taking my approach, and I jump up, and I hit into the bar. And I'm like in shock. And the official comes out right away, and the photographer's all apologetic and so forth. And so they say, well, we'll give you another jump. So I go back. So now here I am. You're talking about, you know, the death toll, you know, death knell for me. I'm on my last jump, and I am just in my mind saying, I am going to be All-American. I remember I almost put my foot through the floor, but I ended up clearing it, and I made All-American. So there is something about this public idea of saying that you're going to be, you know, All-American, or you're going to reach whatever goal you're setting for yourself. But the important part of goal setting, just to give you a few keys about it, are, you know, one, you have to have short-term goals that help you, that lead to this long-term goal that you might have. Goals should always be hard, but realistic, you know, and so for me, being All-American might have, some people might have thought it was unrealistic, but, you know, I thought it was realistic, but certainly a difficult one to achieve. And then, you know, it has to be specific and measurable. You have to know that you're going to get it. You got to know that you're getting there and you can, you know, track it. And then you need to plan. You know, there's no way of getting there if you haven't planned how you're going to achieve this specific goal. And the last thing is you got to continually monitor it. And so those are some tips about goals and goal effective goal setting, and I hope that'll be of some help to you.
Soul food.
You know, today I wanted to talk a little bit more about a book that I had cited from a few times in previous episodes. It's called Virtue and Vice. It's the writings of C.S. Lewis, a famous Christian writer. And it's edited by Patricia Klein, and it was by Harper San Francisco Press. And there's just some great little short blurbs in here about various things. And one of the things he had in here was called pretending. That was the heading of it. And why I thought this was kind of interesting is, you know, one time I had a guy come into my office when we had a practice up in Boston, a sports performance, sports medicine practice. And a guy comes into me, and the first question he asked me is, how do I get a Nike contract? I thought, what do? You know, before I tell you how you're going to get a contract, he said, "Well, I'm a 400 meter runner." And I said, "Well, what do you run?" He said, "I run, you know, quarter." And I said, "Well, how fast?" And he said, "52 seconds." Now, in my head, I'm thinking, "Well, if you want a Nike contract, you have to probably run about a 44 second, 45 second." Yeah, and that's just probably to get equipment, not any kind of money or anything from Nike. So I said to him, "Well, okay." And I looked him over. I looked at some of the things that he did and so forth. And I started to tell him what it was probably going to take to get there. And after that, he looked at me and said, "Well, I don't want to do all that." And I said, "Well, then you're never going to get a Nike contract, you know? What can I tell you?" But it struck me as odd because I think there's a little bit in our society today where people are thinking, I want to look like I have the contract, you know? And I'm thinking, why would you want to wear Nike stuff around pretending that you're something that you're not? And so that's why this sort of caught my attention. I'm just going to read it again. It's not too long. And here it goes. What is the good of pretending to be what you are not? Well, even on a human level, you know there are two kinds of pretending. There is a bad kind, where the pretense is there instead of the real thing, as when a man pretends he is going to help you instead of really helping you. But there's also the good kind, where the pretense leads up to the real thing. When you're not feeling particularly friendly, but you know you ought to be, the best thing you can do very often is to put on a friendly manner and behave as if you were a nicer person than you actually are. And in a few minutes, as we have all noticed, you will be really feeling friendlier than you were before. Very often, the only way to get equality in reality is to start behaving as if you had it already. That is why children's games are so important. They are always pretending to be grown-ups, playing soldiers, playing shop. But all the time, they are hardening their muscles and sharpening their wits so that the pretense of being grown-ups helps them to grow up in earnest. Now, the moment you realize, here I am, dressing up as Christ, it is extremely likely that you will see at once some way in which at that very moment, the pretense could be made less of a pretense and more of a reality. In other words, you could really be being more like Christ than you are. You're just pretending and not really following through on it. You will find several things going on in your mind which would not be going on if you were truly, really a son of God. Well, stop them. Or you may realize that instead of saying your prayers, you ought to be downstairs writing a letter or helping your wife to wash up. Well, go and do it. You see what is happening. The Christ himself, the Son of God, who is man, just like you, and God, just like his Father, is actually at your side and is already at the moment beginning to turn your pretense into a reality. And so what he's basically saying is, stop pretending and go and do it. And if we're talking about Nike contracts, I'll use an old saying, just do it. Well, everybody, thanks for another great show. It was great being with you, and look forward to your feedback and comments. I would love for you to call me. You can leave just a voice message on there just with your comments or ideas or feedback, and I'd love to put that on the show. So the number is 206-203-1301, or you can email me, write me at feedback@reclaimthegame.com, and I'll look forward to being with you again soon. Take care and God bless.